Levy, the study 13 is entitled Wisdom in the Old Testament 1, Proverbs, Wisdom in Life. Now, this is the beginning of three studies in the Old Testament wisdom literature, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes and Job. And it's interesting that they should come at this point in the school after we've already seen Christ as our wisdom, as our righteousness, sanctification and redemption. But I think what Brian said already in the last study tells us why we are now looking at the Old Testament wisdom literature, because they are to make us wise unto salvation through faith in Christ. Some books that go with this study. Jeff's Comprehending series, Jeffrey Bingham, Comprehending the Kingdom of God, God's rule and sovereignty over all things, is crucial to Proverbs. Comprehending the Covenant, which is the context in which Proverbs is written. Comprehending the Fruitfulness of God, the scope that the book of Proverbs covers, is the whole of life. And Comprehending the Family of God and Man, which is the key to understanding the book of Proverbs. Those are all under C. You realise all those books are arranged in alphabetical order? C for comprehending. So the purpose of this study, while giving something of an overview of the book of Proverbs, is to show the place of this book in the whole of the scriptures, and this is true of the other study, rest of the studies this morning, to show the place of this book in the whole of the scriptures in how it relates to the nature, plan and action of God as creator and redeemer. Proverbs of Solomon. Title of the book of Proverbs is The Proverbs of Solomon, Son of David, King of Israel. The bulk of the book is made up of two collections of Solomon's Proverbs, 10:1 to 22:16, headed The Proverbs of Solomon, and 25:1 to 29:27, with the inscription, These are other Proverbs of Solomon that the officials of King Hezekiah of Judah copied, which was quite some time after Solomon. So you see, this book was compiled some time later. These collections of the Proverbs of Solomon amount to 513 verses and so are likely to be a distilled selection of all that Solomon wrote, since we are told he composed 3,000 Proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005. He would speak of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows in the wall. He would speak of animals and birds and reptiles and fish. The writer of Kings is very clear as to where this wisdom of Solomon came from. God gave Solomon very great wisdom, discernment and breadth of understanding as vast as the sand on the seashore. God had said to Solomon, "Ask what I should give you." And Solomon had asked for an understanding mind to govern your people, able to discern between good and evil. God willingly responded, "Indeed, I give you a wise and discerning mind. No one like you has ever been before you, and no one like you shall arise after you." After which all Israel stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was with him to execute justice. We see from this that Solomon's wisdom came directly from God, and that it had to do with discerning good and evil and practicing justice, always that moral dimension, not just common sense. This then is what we would expect to find when we read the book of Proverbs. So what's the relationship of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament to the law and the prophets? Wisdom, law and prophecy. Before David died, he solemnly charged his son Solomon, "I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong, be courageous, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn." So it was no doubt in this spirit that Solomon made his request to God. and God responded. The battle between wisdom and foolishness is inextricably tied up with paying heed to the law of God. Proverbs 28 says, "Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law struggle against them." The word for law here in Hebrew is Torah, the same word used for a mother's and father's teaching in 1:8 and 3:1, but other words are used for instruction. I was looking in chapter 1 in the heading of Proverbs that says this is instruction. I thought if we could say that that's Torah, then we can tie it all together, but it doesn't happen that way, nice and neatly. The word there for learning about wisdom and instruction is Musar, which has overtones of discipline. So while they complement one another, that is the wisdom and the law, sometimes running parallel, sometimes intersecting, a direct equation between the wisdom of Proverbs and the law of Moses cannot be made. The wisdom in Proverbs extends the law of God to practical everyday situations. In the law there is a certain amount of case law, applying it to situations, but Proverbs just opens up the whole of the gamut of everyday life to the dynamic of the law of God. Those who keep the law are wise children, but companions of gluttons shame their parents. This also applies to the practice of religion. When one will not listen to the law, even one's prayers are an abomination. All of this is from God. For all of one's professing the law of God, how can one have wisdom without paying heed to the word that comes from God? Even the stork in the heavens knows its times, and the turtle dove, swallow, and crane observe the time of their coming. But my people do not know the ordinance of Yahweh. How can you say we are wise and the law of Yahweh is with us, when in fact the false pen of the scribes has made it into a lie? The wise shall be put to shame, they shall be dismayed and taken, since they have rejected the word of the Lord, says Jeremiah, what wisdom is in them? The word of the prophets recalled people to the law of God. What does the wisdom of Solomon say about that? He says, where there is no prophecy, the people cast off restraint, but happy are those that keep the law. So there in one verse you've got wisdom talking about prophecy and law, affirming them together. What then was the relationship in the Old Testament between law, wisdom and prophecy? They were seen to be all of a piece and to belong together. As long as they were all from God, they would prevail. Jeremiah 18, instruction shall not perish from the priest, nor counsel from the wise, nor the word from the prophet. Now that was actually said by Jeremiah's enemies and detractors, probably with reference to their own preferred false prophets, but that was the principle that was understood, and the oneness, the belonging together of prophecy, the law and the wisdom belonging together. But one thing I realised when I was reading Proverbs, and you come to Proverbs and you think of it as a collection of wise sayings sort of on its own, but when it talks about God, it talks about Yahweh, who is the covenant God of Israel. That's where wisdom comes from, to fear that God, the covenant God of Israel, is wisdom. So here's a section called The Covenant Mercy of Yahweh. When God revealed himself to Moses, it was not as sheer law, but as Yahweh, the redeeming covenant God of Israel. Yahweh, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, yet by no means clearing the guilty, but visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation, that is, the third and the fourth generation of those who persist in rejecting him. This revelation inculcates a high standard of moral righteousness, a strong sense of sin, a dependence upon the forgiving grace and mercy of God, and above all, an answerability to God in direct relationship with him. All of this is essential for a right reading and understanding of the book of Proverbs, because this is the God that the book of Proverbs says, the fear of this God is the beginning of wisdom. While Proverbs commends and fosters prudence and sagacity in life, it is not in the interests of self-seeking at the expense of justice and truth. While it may be true that misfortune pursues sinners, but prosperity rewards the righteous, this is no recipe for a self-interested prosperity gospel. For better is a little with righteousness than large income with injustice. Better is a little with the fear of Yahweh than great treasure and trouble with it. Better is a dinner of vegetables where love is than a fatted ox and hatred with it. Better the poor walking in integrity than one perverse of speech who is a fool. So in Proverbs one does not pursue righteousness in order to become prosperous, nor in an imperfect world does righteousness necessarily guarantee prosperity. Righteousness and integrity are valued above personal gain at the expense of others. Wise persons in Proverbs know that they are not on their own in this life and are not answerable only to themselves. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength being small, if you hold back from rescuing those taken away to death, those who go staggering to the slaughter, if you say, look, we did not know this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay all according to their deeds? They know that the one who watches over their souls is the one who rescues the poor and needy, as he had rescued poor and needy Israel from slavery in Egypt, the covenant God. Do not remove an ancient landmark or encroach on the fields of orphans, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their cause against you. Before him we are all one, and not over against each other. The rich and the poor have this in common: Yahweh is the maker of them all. We are to reflect in our actions the nature of the one in whose image we are made. Those who oppress the poor insult their maker, but those who are kind to the needy honour him. This is the heart, at the heart of true religion. To do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to Yahweh than sacrifice. That's in Proverbs. To fall short of this righteousness of God is not something that can be shrugged off. Who can say, I have made my heart clean, I am pure from my sin? And so there's no room for self-redemption in Proverbs. Knowing the mercy of God, however, is to know that our evil can be faced rather than concealed. No one who conceals transgressions will prosper, but the one who confesses and forsakes them will obtain mercy. For we know that God provides the means of atonement. By loyalty and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for. It doesn't say whose loyalty and faithfulness there, but it does say, and by the fear of Yahweh, one avoids evil. And so we can take refuge in God. The name of Yahweh is a strong tower. The righteous run into it and are safe. For knowing God, we know that there is a love that covers all offences. The wisdom of the ancients. Such assurance and relationship with God is not present in the wisdom writings that have come down to us from the rest of the ancient world. Here is a sample. God, known or unknown, my transgressions are many. The transgression I have committed, I know not. Whether one does wrong or right, one knows not. I wish I knew that these things were pleasing to one's God. Hear the heart cry coming there, which can't be answered except by Israel's God. Solomon, on the other hand, as we've seen, was grounded in the law of Moses, concerning which Moses had already said, "See, just as Yahweh my God has charged me, I now teach you statutes and ordinances for you to observe in the land that you're about to enter and occupy. You must observe them diligently, for this will show your wisdom and discernment to the peoples who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and discerning people.'" Hardly surprising is it then that when we hear that as a result of God's gift, some of which is we see enshrined in Proverbs, Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman, Chalcol and Dada, children of Mahol. Heard of them? You have heard of Solomon though, haven't you? His fame spread throughout all the surrounding regions. So they must have been great men, and they weren't Israelites. People came from all the nations to hear the wisdom of Solomon. They came from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. So we see from this that Solomon was not the only wise person in the ancient world. There was Ethan the Ezrahite and the sons of Mahol, among many others. There was a widespread interest in wisdom, particularly among the ruling classes. I guess once you are in a position of responsibility for running a country, you want to know wisdom. And that Solomon asked for that from the right source. But the others were very interested in it too. And you may be surprised, some of our parliamentary leaders are asking for that too, and are glad to receive it when they get it. Some collections of ancient wisdom have survived to this day and make interesting comparisons with the wisdom of Israel. Much of it contains satirical observations on human nature, lessons from experience, and tactful worldly wise advice on personal advancement, sometimes mixed with dubious morality and polytheistic relativism, all such as we might hear from a modern day highly paid motivational speaker. Sometimes it reaches heights of moral insight that match what we find in Proverbs. In a number of instances, the two run closely parallel. There was clearly much interplay in this field between Israel and its neighbours. All those people who came to Solomon, I'm sure, would have been very interested to hear from them as well. Accordingly, Solomon's writings are not the only ones included in the book of Proverbs. Alongside the two collections of Solomon's Proverbs are two other collections entitled The Words of the Wise. And these, that's 22:17 to 24:22, and these also are the sayings of the wise, 24:23 to 34. Added to these are the words of Achur, son of Jaki, we looked at some of those the other day, and the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. The sources of these sayings are by no means necessarily Israelite. Lemuel is the name of no known king in Israel, just as Job was a man in the land of Uz. Job was not an Israelite. Wisdom and creation. We might expect the wisdom in Proverbs to extend beyond the confines of Israel, since the earth is the Lord's, the earth is Yahweh's, and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it. God had said to Israel, "All the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." That's not "all the earth is mine, but you shall be." All the earth is mine, and because all the earth is mine, you will be the priest nation to all the earth, belonging to me. Israel's appointed task then was to head up the worship of all the nations before God. And Malachi says, or God says through Malachi, "From the rising of the sun to its setting, my name is great among the nations." And the implication is greater than it is at the moment in Israel. "And in every place incense is offered to my name and a pure offering, for my name is great among the nations, says Yahweh of hosts." So Yahweh of hosts is no less capable of revealing himself to a Job or a Melchizedek as he is to Abraham and his descendants. This was in anticipation of the reality of the holy city in the new heaven and new earth, where people will bring into it the glory and honour of the nations, purged from all that is unclean. Hence Paul the Apostle was able to say to the Corinthians, "All things are yours," not only Paul or Apollos or Cephas, but also the world, life, death, the present and the future. Because the Corinthians belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. The book of Proverbs is not narrowly religious, nor ethnically specific. It ranges across the whole of life and human experience, and the whole of creation. Nothing less than this could do justice to the wisdom of the one who has created all things in wisdom. Chapters 1 to 9 of Proverbs set the tone and provide the interpretive key to the right understanding of the whole book. Part of what that introduction does, especially in chapter 8, is to make the point that the only wisdom by which you can handle everyday things in conformity with their nature is the wisdom by which they were divinely made and ordered. The keynote of the whole book is the fear of Yahweh. This phrase occurs at significant points in the introductory chapters, 1 to 9. They're listed there, about 5 occurrences in the first 9 chapters. But also, and also at other points throughout the book. And the rest of those are listed there. One of our up-and-coming young scholars says, "Where chapters 1 to 9 act as a starting point for the attainment of wisdom, clearly indicating that the fear of Yahweh is the point of departure, chapters 10 to 31 demonstrate what life directed by the fear of Yahweh might look like." We've already said that this is not just any God, but the God whom Israel knew by covenant as their Father and Redeemer from of old. Of about 100 proverbs that mention God, all but a dozen use the covenant name Yahweh. It is the fear of this God that is the beginning of knowledge, hatred of evil, the beginning of wisdom, and a fountain of life. What is the fear of Yahweh? We've looked at this in an earlier study, study 3, where we saw it has much to do with obedience to God and his law, a healthy and wholesome regard for moral consequences, and also a good estimate of who we are as creatures and our creaturely limitation. The fear of Yahweh. Here in Proverbs we note particularly that it subsists in a vital relationship with God. See how the two parts of this verse parallel each other. "Then you will understand the fear of Yahweh and find the knowledge of God." So fear of Yahweh, knowledge of God are in parallel. Here, the fear of Yahweh is equated with the knowledge of God. And knowledge in the Bible is not just intellectual, but relational. It is knowing God, not just knowing about God. So also, the fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Knowing Him is insight. This relational knowledge of God, as in any personal relationship, comes by God revealing Himself to a person. And out of that relationship will come all the wisdom that is needed in life. For Yahweh gives wisdom. From His mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk blamelessly, guarding the paths of justice and preserving the way of His faithful ones. Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity, every good path. For wisdom will come into your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Prudence will watch over you, and understanding will guard you. It will save you from the way of evil. Timothy, Jesus, schooled in that. Such a relationship with God necessarily involves trust. It is the relationship of faith. Trust in the Lord, in Yahweh, with all your heart, and do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will make straight your paths. So trust in Yahweh is no less true in Proverbs than it is in Isaiah, Habakkuk, and Paul. The purpose given for the words of the wise could well apply to the whole book of Proverbs, so that your trust may be in the Lord. I have made them known to you today, yes, to you. And John finishes his gospel with the same thing. I've written these things that you may believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. True wisdom is knowing the One who accomplishes all things according to His counsel and will, the sovereignty of Yahweh. The human mind may devise many plans, but it is the purpose of Yahweh that will be established. Now we want to just finish by looking at some samples of wisdom in life. You can't go right through the whole book. It's a lifetime's work, really. But we'll see now how this is borne out in some of the wisdom in living that Proverbs imparts. Derek Kidner reminds us the introduction, verses 2-6 of chapter 1, an extension of the title, makes it clear this book is no anthology but a course of education in the life of wisdom. Let me read that to you. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for learning about wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for gaining instruction in wise dealing, righteousness, justice and equity, to teach shrewdness to the simple, knowledge and prudence to the young. Let the wise also hear and gain in learning, and the discerning acquire skill. To understand a proverb and figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. Our young essayist, Sam Bleeby, has commented, because 1-9 seeks to orient the student towards wisdom not just with the mind but with the whole person, that is, in relationship with God. Its message is not one of lists of wise choices to be learned by rote, but is a message of character forged by the fear of Yahweh and tested in day-to-day life. Proverbs, then, should not be read as a list of commands, a list of rules for wise living, but as a compendium of character-formed choices towards wisdom and away from folly. With this in mind, we'll look briefly at four related areas of life touched on in Proverbs: business, friendship, family, and marriage. And in looking at these, we'll also see how they cross-reference to other parts of the Scriptures, particularly the New Testament. Now, up to now, I've been quoting Proverbs extensively, but I can't do this now under pressures of time. So these are resources for you for further I encourage you, if just to pick one of these sections and then look up all the references, and you've got a little compendium on these things in the whole light of the fear of the Lord. Business. Biblical scholars don't always follow this through because they're not sort of business-minded, but I have a son-in-law who's interested in starting a business, and he is asking me, what advice can the Bible give me about running a business? And I thought, well, we could start in Proverbs, eh? And this could be the outline of a little handbook for a Christian businessman. Business savvy, whether in primary production or in manufacture and trade, is based on an awareness that you need to know God. Yahweh directs the steps. And to work with others, take their advice. Effectively, the two great commandments, to love God and to love other people. Why should we be surprised? There are stern warnings against the folly of trying to make a quick buck. The peril of covetousness, which is idolatry, says it will always fail. And isn't that having global repercussions today? The whole prime mortgage thing was a quick buck thing, which is now affecting the whole of the global economy. Shouldn't we be reading Proverbs? Quite simple, really. Diligence and hard work pay off. This is the business that God has given everyone to be busy with. Honesty and justice are to be the hallmarks of business dealings, because that is the way God is. Lots about diverse weights and measures, or withholding sales to keep the price up. Again, the G8 should be reading Proverbs. And OPEC. There is to be a shrewd understanding of people's self-serving propensities. You've got to realise that in the world of business, a gift can get you a long way. But scrupulous straightforwardness in the matters of justice and eschewing of bribery to pervert the course of justice is a no-no. Why is that? Because our God is partial and is not partial and takes no bribe. It's quite amazing that for the most part our Western economic system doesn't work on bribery and corruption. In many places where it does, or when it does, it's brought to light as something that's not particularly smiled upon. That's because there's a God who is not partial and doesn't take a bribe. So we can be free of all that and just be straightforward in our dealings. It's good, isn't it? But all of this is a matter of, as Jesus said, being wise as serpents and innocent as doves, knowing what goes on, not getting embroiled in it. The foolishness of accepting unlimited liability for another is to be eschewed. Lots of that. Don't go guarantor for anybody. But that's easy credit. And that's got our economy into heaps of trouble also. Only God can ransom another person's life. Don't take that on for them. So there's a good little basis for a handbook on business management, isn't it? And you could add to that from the New Testament a bit about employer-employee relationships. Slaves obey your masters and so on. Friendship. I think that's something we're all interested in. Forgiveness and love lie at the heart of stable friendship. Both those are held up in Proverbs, forgiveness and love, rather than what we can get out of people. If you're in a friendship for what you can get out of the other person, that's not what you find in Proverbs. Forgiveness and love can leave room for mutual correction. good friend is one who will tell you what you don't want to hear. Friendship is to be, and a good friend is someone who will listen to that and accept the rebuke. Friendship is to be actively fostered, even on a level with family relationships. Value friendship and keep it going over the years, over the decades. But it is as well not to live too much in each other's pockets. That's wise, isn't it? We need to know when to lay off. Proverbs tells us that. And all of this, I believe, is because friendship with God is the true way to friendship with others, as we find elsewhere in the scriptures. Family. I used to think the Bible says very little, actually, about raising children. There's the bit in Deuteronomy where it says you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength, and you shall teach this to your children. So that you keep these words I'm commanding you this today in your heart, recite them to your children and talk about them when you're at home and when you're away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand, fix them as an emblem on your forehead. So in everything you do, everything you think, let this love of God be there. And write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Let the whole atmosphere of your home suffuse this love of God. And I thought, well, there's that, and then there's the little bits in the epistles that talk about parents and children. But then you come to Proverbs, and the entire format of Proverbs, as teaching advice of parents to their children, my son, heed a father's instruction and listen to your mother's teaching, is just the explication of Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 9. And a whole book that does that. It's a practical exposition of the heart of Israel's law in day-to-day life that was to be heard by parents and children alike. We have instances where the law is read out and the children are there with their parents to hear it. And an application of the commandment with a promise. Honour your father and mother. Listen to a father's instruction and your mother's teaching. Discipline of children is to be in the light of God's disciplining of us as our father. There's a little section on family. Now we finish at... Pardon? Two more minutes, okay. Marriage. The one mention in Proverbs of the covenant of God is in connection with marriage. You will be saved from the loose woman, from the adventuress with her smooth words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. Marriage between one man and one woman for life is highly prized as being approved by God. Don't know what Solomon knew about that, but anyway. Mostly underneath the rulers, one man, one woman marriage pertained in Israel. And that's what's reflected here. And in those early parts of Proverbs, wisdom has a lot to do with, as Dean has reminded us, being faithful to the wife a few years. And not going the way of the adulterer. The downside of difficult marriages is recognised. So it's realistic there. In the introductory chapters, dalliance with foolishness is represented as sexual immorality and unfaithfulness with a loose woman or an adulteress, in contrast to a right relationship with wisdom as with a sister or a wife. Right at the end of the book of Proverbs is a depiction of the capable wife. She is a remarkable figure in herself, a wise and caring ministry with her husband and family, a competent, diligent and astute businesswoman in trade, real estate, primary production and cottage industry, manufacturing and value adding with a view to merchandising, small business and personnel management, and service to the wider community, especially the poor and needy. Exhausting. all the while not neglecting herself and her own appearance, being held in high esteem by her husband, children and all others, the secret of her inner strength and beauty is that she fears Yahweh. She is a real life person, but there are also what appear to be deliberate cross references to the allegorical female figure of wisdom in the earlier chapters. The capable wife is far more precious than jewels. Compare what is attributed to wisdom. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her. And at the end of the depiction of the good wife, we feel the same vibes. It's in the vibes. We feel the same vibes coming through as we feel with regard to the earlier female figure of wisdom. It appears that the book of Proverbs concludes with the virtual incarnation of wisdom in a good wife, perhaps in anticipation of what the New Testament will have to say about the bride of Christ, in contrast to the foolish Babylon. If this is so, then this is wisdom in life indeed.